for those of you who are joining us for the first time. Tonight, I'll be giving a Dharma talk. And our tradition is that we sit in our Zazen posture, in our meditation posture, and just let the words flow over you and see what, if anything, resonates for you. And then we'll sit comfortably and we'll have a Dharma dialogue. So we began our reading tonight with a reading from Okamura, who is one of the great modern writers about Zen and one of the great interpreters of the Zen master Dogen. And he writes lines that I think are so powerful in trying to explain what this practice of meditation is actually for. He writes, "Zazen enables us to see clearly that we are part of the world, part of nature, part of Buddha. There is no separate individual who practices Zazen and becomes enlightened. No separate individual doing this practice." And of course, our first reaction is, but wait a minute, who's sitting here? Who's in this little Zoom square tonight? Who is having these thoughts? Who is feeling the cushion on my butt? And of course, this is the great dilemma and mystery of Zen, where we ask the question, who is this sitting here? Who is this having these thoughts? Of course, the question is, who are we in relation to each other, in relation to other people? The practice of mindfulness, of cultivating mindful attention, is on its face a completely solitary activity. Here we are, sitting alone on our cushions or in our chairs. And even if we were together, which we are many times on retreats, we're very much alone and together. And so mindfulness can seem like not just a solitary activity, but an activity that's for me, that is fundamentally a self-improvement project. And we know that there is a whole wellness industry that is about self-improvement, about a me who needs to be fixed, and a set of techniques that I can use to fix me. So this natural preoccupation that I have with I, with me, with what's mine, this can get recapitulated in a spiritual practice. And in fact, these wonderful minds keep telling us that we are separate, we're isolated, there's a me that persists through time, there's a me who was a 2-year-old and a me who was a 30-year-old, and now this old guy who's the same me. And what Zen practice asks us to do is to look at these delusive ways that our minds construct ourselves and the world. Delusive meaning not true. You know, the ancient teachers and the modern teachers keep telling us that meditation, Zazen, is about seeing reality more clearly. Because what the Buddha understood, and countless people before and after him, was that our minds don't tell us the truth about reality, that they form delusive ideas about what mindfulness is, what wisdom is, what compassion is. But perhaps the greatest delusion is this delusion of a separate fixed self. And of course, that delusion is borne out whenever I sit on my cushion. I have spent hours, days at Zen retreats, completely preoccupied with myself, preoccupied with whether I'm doing this practice right, preoccupied with why that person on the cushion next to me is annoying me so much, preoccupied with how I'm making mistakes at every turn as I do this practice. And in fact, there have been times where I have spent an entire week of retreat simply lost in the preoccupation of self, lost in what David Foster Wallace calls our tiny skull-sized kingdoms, completely unable to get a sense of anything beyond I, me, and mine. Painful, but also entirely vivid. In fact, what this practice does is reminds us that we can't simply tell ourselves not to be preoccupied with the self. We can tell ourselves that, but it doesn't work. That really, what practice does is it allows us to exhaust this preoccupation with self. Exhaust it to a point that we see beyond it, that we really sense the loosening of those boundaries between me and the world, between me and you, between my mind and your mind. And that when these boundaries loosen, we really know in our bones that this delusion of a fixed separate self is just that, and a helpful delusion when it comes to knowing that you should log on at 7:15 or 7:30 to hang, to meditate. Yes, a helpful delusion of a separate self that does that. And so we go through the world using that conception, but that at the deepest level, we are not separate. And that leads us to real compassion. That leads us beyond the selfishness of I, me, and mine. The Dalai Lama is fond of saying, if you would like to be selfish, you should do it in a very intelligent way. The stupid way to be selfish is seeking happiness for ourselves alone. The intelligent way to be selfish is to work for the welfare of others. But we only know this through practice. And of course, I study human beings as they go through their lives, and one of the things we find so dramatically when we study thousands of people is that the people who take care of others are by far the happiest and the healthiest. So in fact, science tells us through this other lens what our spiritual teachers have been telling us for millennia. The truth of seeing beyond the self and caring beyond the self. Now, all of this sounds good, but I'm sure many of you have heard the complaint that I hear and I read about, which is that, if anything, we are becoming less moral, less kind to each other over time. That we are declining as a species. And in fact, one of my students was asking, why should I take the Bodhisattva precepts? Why should I take those vows to treat other people well, when nobody is treating anybody else well now? That morality has gone away. And so I actually began to read about this, and I found a wonderful new piece of scientific research. It was published in one of the most important scientific journals in the world, the journal Nature, quite rigorous. And the title of the study is The Illusion of Moral Decline. What the investigators noted was that, yes, we are all sure that as a species, we humans are nastier to each other. Kindness is waning. And so they asked the question, have we always felt this way? And they went back and found data over time through 75 years in which people were asked, do you think that morality is declining? And over again, over 75 years, hundreds of thousands of people said, yes, morality is declining. But when they ask people, were you treated with decency and kindness yesterday? Over 75 years, most people said yes. So in fact, there is no decline. And in fact, when they look at all the atrocities that are so painful and so evident in our world, and they trace atrocities through time, atrocities, believe it or not, are decreasing rather than increasing. Again, hard to believe because our minds tell us that it is all getting much worse and that we as human beings are no longer kind to each other. So then the question is, why is this? Why do we perceive that it's not worth investing in each other? That it is not worth taking precepts in which we vow to be kind and compassionate? And again, our ancient teachers could have told us what the psychologists tell us today, that in fact, our minds are biased toward what's wrong, toward what's negative. It is simply what we are more likely to remember and give importance to. We forget what's good, we ignore what's good, and we prioritize what's wrong. And of course, as you know, this is what the media thrives on. This is what clickbait involves. Right? Knowing that our minds will gravitate toward these things. And also, what we know is that we tend to idealize the past. We tend to whitewash our memories. And where that leaves us is with a perception that everything is getting worse and that it was all better in the past. Neither of which turns out to be true. Now, does that mean the world is really a wonderful place? Of course not. Of course, suffering is still perpetrated over and over again in horrific wars, in small and large ways. Violence, abuse, not to be denied, not to be turned away from. But that is different from the perception that it is all getting worse and we are less moral as a species. And therefore, it is not worth doing what we are doing here, which is committing ourselves not just to waking up to reality, but to a process of waking up that inspires moral conduct. That the great reveal of this practice is that our minds do mislead us. And they mislead us into separation, into othering, into withdrawing from each other. These minds that are so good at helping us survive are not so good at helping us see life as it truly is. And so what practice keeps urging us to do is look again and again and again at what's real. That's what's happening just in this moment. And then what emerges is what's hidden in plain sight, is our intimate connections to each other and to everything. That practice becomes a corrective for these distortions of the mind that separate us from each other and from what's good. And so we keep coming back to the reason for living according to the Bodhisattva precepts. And the goal of practice, as Okamura tells us, is not individual improvement. As he says, we don't personally become a Buddha, but rather we awaken to the reality that from the beginning, we are living Buddhas. Life. Thank you.